Hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals draw near, for the court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Please be seated. Good morning. We're here for argument in the Article 62 appeal in the case of the United States v. Mobley. A couple of administrative things. Given the size of our court this morning and the nature of the issues that we have in front of us, the complexity of these issues, we're going to expand our argument to 45 minutes per side. We will also take a break in between argument from the government and the defense in this case. One other housekeeping note, Judge Harney is ill this morning. She will not be here on the court. However, she will be participating and she'll listen in on the argument which is being recorded. Government, I understand that you wanted to reserve, I think, 7 minutes. Is that whatever?
Yes, Your Honor.
Are both sides prepared to argue?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
Government, you may proceed.
Chief Judge Rome, members of the court, may it please the court, my name is Major Leo Lugano, and along with Mr. Roger Bruce, we represent the government in this matter. The military judge had a predetermined outcome, and there was nothing that this trial counsel could do to combat this mission impossible. Not letting all our superior court case law involving senior officials and public comments get in the way, the military judge ruled that the defense met proved some evidence of UCI, allowing them to sidestep their burden completely. Then, without missing a beat, the military judge discarded a general officer's sworn statement, treating it with the same regard as a convicted service member, without allowing him to come and testify.
Before you get into your argument, I know several people that have an issue, just like your comments, keep them brief, with regard to why are we here this morning? I mean, the judge gave you an opportunity to bring this case before him again or to another judge by re-referring it. He dismissed it without prejudice. What's the purpose of this Article 62 at this time?
Well, first, Your Honor, we believe that the remedy won't work. If the judge ruled that there was actual UCI and apparent UCI, this would become a Groundhog Day of pre-referral, referral, challenge, and then sent back for referral. So first, we don't believe that the remedy would actually work and get us back to court. Second, the president and the chief of staff are accused of UCI, and the government cannot let that ruling stand. Some examples of the absurd lengths the military judge went to justify his ruling include, first, that his ruling of actual UCI with regard to the president could be cured by a new referral. If this is the case, then there is no clean referral by any commander in the U.S. military.
Let me ask you, from your briefs here, that your position is that Article 37 is not binding on the United States of America.
Yes, Your Honor.
And along those lines, let me ask you, the president would make a statement where he says, if you're a military officer on a court-martial panel, and you do not sentence someone accused of or convicted of a sexual offense to maximum punishment, you will not be promoted. Do you believe the president would be authorized to make that statement?
If the president made that statement, that may be a due process violation. That would not be an Article 37 violation.
So why does it even matter whether the president is encompassed within Article 37? It would be a due process violation nonetheless. Isn't that a purely technical question at that point?
Well, the burden for the defense to determine, to show due process violation, is whether the accused's alleged right is of such extraordinary weighty factor as to overcome the balance struck by Congress. And that was recently validated in U.S. v. Vasquez, 72 MJ 13, originally stated in Weiss v. U.S., 510 U.S. 163.
So I guess your argument is then that, well, I'm not sure. Are you arguing we should be looking at this from a due process issue? Should we be looking at it strictly from the statutory constructs of Article 37? What would you recommend that this court do?
If there was a violation, it would be a due process violation, but there was no due process violation. Now, this is regarding to the president's comments. There's also allegations involving the chief of staff, who is subject to the code.
Right, but the military judge found, in fact, you said actual, apparently you found actual UCI from the president's comments.
Yes, Your Honor.
So should we not address that under due process concerns?
We should, Your Honor. We should. If there's any concerns, it should be looked at for due process implications. Another absurdity is while finding both the preferral and referral commander's affidavits had the exact same content in his finding of facts and noting on the record how remarkably similar the two affidavits were, the judge found one to be sufficient and one not. And that's at Appellate Exhibit 4, page 110, and the record at page 116.
I want to ask you about that. With respect to the affidavit,
I do, Your Honor. First, the affidavit was in response to defense's boilerplate motion, which had sound bites and accusations, no connection to United States v. Mobley. So they were responding to that motion. And in responding to that motion, they chose to attack the entire allegation. And I think that was a fair assumption. It was the right assumption under the law, given that the military judge's ruling, where he narrowed it down to three things, had not yet occurred. The unwitnessed, I think, is irrelevant under, first it goes to, not doesn't go to veracity. There's no allegations that this document was forged. So it's common to introduce declarations signed under the penalty of perjury without a witness, and it's validated by, 28 U.S.C., 1746 and 10 U.S.C. 931, which talks about the language that was used here without a witness.
Don't we apply the abuse of discretion standard for the judge on what evidence he finds sufficient or not in a case like that?
I'm sorry, sir?
Don't we apply an abuse of discretion standard to the judge's determination on whether to accept that, we'll call it an affidavit as it's entitled, but whether to accept it as written or not? I mean, who is this court to decide the judge doesn't have enough information on how much credibility to give that document? That's what we pay the judge to do.
He looked at that fact and found that it did not meet the government's burden, thus there was UCI, and therefore it should be a de novo review under U.S. v. Wallace. Well, so by applying the facts and finding that it didn't meet the burden, that would still be under the U.S. v. Wallace standard.
I think first he has to determine if UCI has been raised by the defense, and he's going to look at the statements made by the president, the chief of staff, and others. So I'm not sure he's using that affidavit to determine if UCI exists, if I heard you correctly. Is that what you said?
Well, yes. At that second step, he's looking to see whether the government needs one of their three options to rebut the presumption that some evidence of UCI has been raised. And so in doing that, he is looking at those affidavits to determine whether UCI was actually influencing this process.
So your view is that the affidavit by the GCMCA is sufficient to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that UCI apparent or actual did not exist in this case. Now, in United States v. Wallace cited in your brief, Our Superior Court specifically warned military judges not to rely on, quote, perfunctory statements from subordinates or, quote, blanket assertion of a subordinate in rank that he was not influenced. How is this affidavit, declaration, what have you, how is this more than a perfunctory statement or a blanket assertion?
First, Your Honor, the military judge accepted the peripheral commander's statement, which had similar the same content as the first general. So he accepted that as meeting the standard.
But the president's comments came in between peripheral and referral, so wouldn't it make sense that he holds the GCMCA to a higher standard?
Yes, and would be, I don't know about a higher standard, but a standard involving different statements. And I think when you're talking about the general statement, you have to take into account that when he preferred these charges, he did not prefer all, when he referred these charges, he did not refer all the sexual assault charges. So if we're looking at an affidavit where a general is swearing that he looked at this case and was not influenced by senior officers, the fact that he did not just blindly refer all the charges speaks greatly to that, what weight that ever should be given.
But it seems like I read the judge's determination, and the way I read it is that he just wasn't comfortable with what the affidavit itself as being sufficient to meet the government's burden. It's not that he's saying he didn't believe the GCMCA. It's he didn't answer all the questions that had been raised with regard to, the question on the invisible war and whether he had referenced it. Why isn't that within the judge's discretion to decide how much evidence is necessary to overcome your burden as the government to prove beyond a reasonable doubt? Isn't that a fair reading of his ruling?
Your Honor, his ruling is based on some erroneous factual assertions that we believe calls into question the foundation of his ruling. For example, with talking about the Chief of Staff's order to watch the invisible war, the Chief of Staff stated that he called all wing commanders to D.C. and ordered them to watch the invisible war. Neither the peripheral commander nor the referral commander are wing commanders. So when he makes the leap to say they were exposed to the war, from that factual statement, that's clearly erroneous. He also stated that it wasn't the watching of the film. It wasn't the watching of the film that he was concerned with. It was the command message. Second, the peripheral commander did not mention whether he watched this movie or not, and the judge did not remark on that at all in his decision.
So you would say that the judge's determination of a command environment of, I'm not sure, how did you put it, a command influence? I apologize, I missed command message. That's not something he should consider? I mean, if the Chief of Staff is out there stoking the fires and saying, all my wing commanders had better take this seriously, but not only that, I better see some results in trial, you better get me some convictions. Isn't that a command message, and isn't that command influence?
Well, sir, the evidence before the military judge was that he ordered his wing commanders, the Air Force wing commanders, to D.C. to watch this movie. There was no other evidence before this judge that a command message went out about this movie to other commanders. The general court-martial commanding authority was he was superior to the wing commander. So it just is not... it's just not reasonable.
So is your position that the NAF commander here, convening authority, was clueless to what was going on in the Air Force with respect to why everyone came to D.C. to watch the Invisible War and all the other comments that were being made out there?
No, Your Honor. His affidavit does talk about that he's aware of statements by senior military and civilian officials, and that it didn't affect him, his decision in this case.
And in the trial judge's fault, there was this evidence that was presented to him, such as the Chief of Staff's comments, that he brought all 164 Air Force wing commanders, those most influential in shaping our Air Force environment climate installation level, aware of statements made by senior leaders, to combine those to come to his conclusions, his findings of fact? Or are you saying that he's barred from doing that?
In this case, the judge went too far. He took a statement about wing commanders and supplemented it beyond what is reasonable. There's just no evidence in this case. And also, when you look at defense's motion, they do a shotgun approach. They basically lay out all these sound bites and so-called evidence from other cases, and they present it to the government and to the judge. And the trial counsel has to answer that motion in a reasonable way, in a case where the convening authorities were deployed at the time of this hearing. They're both in deployed locations. So, in fact, first, before we even get to whether this affidavit is reasonable, the defense has to meet their burden, which they did not do here. The judge abandoned his impartial role and relieved defense of their burden. There's no case precedent where public comments by senior officials to the media met defense's burden.
Are you aware of any other cases where the public comments made were similar to those in tone and depth and stuff as to the comments made in this case?
Yes. In United States v. Simpson, 58 MJ 368, involved comments from senior military and civilian leadership about sexual assault cases. The comments included no leniency, severe punishment. There is no such thing as consensual sex between drill sergeants and trainees. These were attributed to the Secretary of the Army, the Chief of Staff of the Army, and other officials. In that case, our Superior Court specifically, explicitly endorsed public comments about military justice goals and expectations. The court noted that the prohibition against UCI does not require senior military and civilian officials to refrain from addressing those concerns in response to press inquiries, press releases, and similar communications. And in that case, there were articles about that appellant's case.
Counsel,
yes, sir.
If I can turn you to apparent UCI, what does the government contend is the standard for defining apparent UCI?
Well, to find apparent UCI...
In case law, what are you referring to case law?
From Simpson and also U.S. v. Ayers, there has to be a link to that particular case. So you cannot just allege, as defense did here, that command influence was in the air. So
I think the standard is, and this is from Lewis, that whether an objective, disinterested observer fully informed of all the facts and circumstances would lay harbor significant doubt about the fairness of the proceedings. So the comments you're referring to, the general comments, wouldn't an objective observer contend that the President of the United States making a statement of relevance that he did affect the fairness of the proceedings? Isn't that a fair assumption?
Well, first, Your Honor, in this case, we are talking about the pre-referral and referral stage. We're not talking about punishment. The President's comments in this case with referring to prosecuting sexual assaults is referring to cases or situations where the accused has committed sexual assault. So in other words, my expectation is that we prosecute cases where someone commits sexual assault. I don't think a reasonable observer would believe that that is an unfair statement and would unfairly influence a court-martial. If there were any concerns about punishment, then those could be vetted out during voir dire, or voir dire of the judge or the panel members, depending on which way they chose to go. In Simpson, they also talked about zero tolerance policies that were in trainings and programs, and the court specifically stated to look at the training and experience of others. Defense did not interview the convening authorities in this case, and that's at the record, page 166.
In Simpson, had there, and I apologize if I missed this in the facts of the case, you've sort of equated them and say, hey, Simpson was a little bit like this one, and that there was the, you know, the overall public message and the atmosphere, some of the terms, you know, that we have used. In Simpson, was there a situation where two general court martial convening authorities had recently sort of been pilloried in the press for specifically regarding their actions with respect to cases over which they, you know, exercised some responsibility? That seemed to be a distinguishing factor in my mind. What's your thoughts on that?
Yes, in that case, there were convening authorities who had made some comments, and then the cases were pulled from those convening authorities. So here we have no such statements. All we have is a referral and referral that's in compliance with the code, and with a referral that doesn't include all the sexual assault charges that were investigated. And there was no allegations of UCI in that investigation. So if we look at the training and the experience of these officers, you look at the rank and the position of these officers, and it's assured that without counter evidence, they did not take these statements out of context and compromise their individual duties as convening authorities. Defense asked the court to take a leap and assume that they did without any evidence. And in U.S. v. Ayers, our Superior Court stated where defense could not show a link between a particular case and the statements, it did not appear unfair as a result of UCI.
But in Ayers, the link that was missing there is that the members in court, the defense could not show that the members in court had actually heard the statements at issue. Here, the government has admitted that the convening authorities have heard, or at least were generally aware of statements that were made at issue in this case.
Yes, Your Honor. And if the judge had any questions about those specific comments, the general was on the phone in Iraq ready to testify to the judge and answer any specific questions that he had. But the judge had already made up his mind and did not grant reconsideration. So the...
So then the government had the opportunity to call that witness at the first part of the hearing? They chose not to?
They did choose not to because at that point in time, the military judge had not found in a final ruling that defense had met their burden of UCI and had not specifically stated which portions of this motion the judge was concerned about. So there's this huge list of issues. They rebut it with an affidavit that is unrebutted, and there's no question about the credibility of these officers. Defense provided nothing about these convening authorities or their actions. And so under those circumstances, the government met its burden.
You seem to be implying that the military judge had to be swayed by the fact that he was a two-star convening authority and accept him at his word. I mean, that's the way you kind of phrased that, or at least that's what it appears.
Your Honor, it's not that that a judge has to take a general's word at his word, but when you are under Superior Court precedent, they direct you to look at the training and experience of those members, the hearer, as they put it. So I think it is valid for the military judge to have to take that into account when he's looking at these statements.
And how do we know he didn't?
His ruling doesn't indicate that he did.
Simply by virtue of the fact that he didn't accept it?
Well, he didn't accept it, but he accepted the referral commander's affidavit. There's inconsistencies that indicate that the judge was not impartially looking at this affidavit.
Are you implying that he didn't give due weight to the convening authority's affidavit? I mean, the way I read this, he said that the referral authority has a lower threshold, only has to have some belief that the event or the crime took place. He was satisfied with that. He had other questions with regard to whether the convening authority, who's the last step in determining whether the charges go to trial, was influenced or not. I mean, why isn't that, and case law says that the military judge is the last sentinel to ensure that the accused gets a fair trial and is not the product of undue influence. So why isn't that exactly what he did here? I simply don't have enough information. I require more. You haven't met your burden, government. Come back when you can do it right. That's what judges do. They make decisions like that.
In this case, the judge's ruling about the preferred commander's burden is illogically connected to whether a parent or a parent UCI infected the process. There is no reason that the referral commander, who has to swear under oath that he believes the charges, the offenses took place, that he would be under a lesser burden or a lesser standard to show, the government has a lesser standard to show that there was apparent, or there was no apparent UCI or actual UCI.
But counsel, couldn't that work both ways though? I mean, if he accepted the affidavit for the preferral, your argument would also suggest that maybe he shouldn't have. Not that he should have accepted the affidavit for the referral, but maybe he shouldn't have accepted the affidavit for the preferral. So I think you got to be careful there that because one affidavit he found sufficient necessarily means the other one should be sufficient. I think you could be argued either way. But I think I'm more concerned with what exactly is the government, how do you feel the government met its burden beyond a reasonable doubt? Is it really just this half-page three-paragraph affidavit or is it, the commander says, I heard those, it didn't mean anything, that's all that needs to be done here to meet the burden?
Your Honor, the defense in this case, first, they conceded that affidavit can meet the government's burden for beyond a reasonable doubt.
Well, I'm looking at the content of the affidavit, not just the fact that there was an affidavit.
The content of the affidavit was drafted to show that the commander considered the facts of this case and in a standard way, as he standardly refers every case, he independently decided that case. Now, these statements were, again, in reference to defense's motion. They did not, when they drafted the affidavit, there was no ruling from the military judge about what statements the judge had a problem with. So it's just not reasonable for them to have gone through every statement in the defense's motion. It's not necessary.
So you're saying that the military judge has to first rule if there's a showing of UCI before the government will then determine how much evidence it's going to put on?
No, Your Honor, it's not necessary, but in this case, in the interest of justice, that would have been the case. For example, if they had ruled on the UCI, the first burden, and then given the government the chance at reconsideration, because that's how the process played out here. They both filed their motions prior to the hearing. They went and argued. The judge made his final ruling. Government immediately asked for reconsideration. They were prepared to put the general on the stand if necessary. It was clear the judge had questions about three specific issues out of all the issues that defense raised. And so they were ready. The general was on the phone. And the judge indicated that he would be willing to hear that. And then he changed his mind. And so he did it. He had made enough. He had enough information. And he made up his mind. So under those circumstances, this is not the judge. UCI was not proved. It was rebutted by the government beyond a reasonable doubt. And the judge abused his discretion when he did not allow reconsideration.
Was he required to give reconsideration? That's totally within the discretion of the judge. So how is he abusing discretion that he, as far as I'm concerned, solely has?
In the case that even the military judge cites, U.S. v. Harrison, it talks about the military judge granting reconsideration in the interests of justice. And that is what we have here. If you look at his remedy, dismissal without prejudice, that there's no prejudice to the accused to allow reconsideration at that point to prove no UCI.
And there's no burden to the government to go back and answer his questions. So that's what I started this out with. Why are we here? Why not just do what the military judge ordered, which is go back, get the evidence that he thought was important to make his ruling, and then this would obviously have been done a lot quicker than going through the appellate process, but you would have had resolution to the very issues that you're seeking before us. Why not do that?
Your Honor, the judge's ruling included a ruling of actual UCI on the part of the president. And under those circumstances, the government cannot let that stand.
How? Why not? I mean, where, have you had a landslide of other decisions in which that has been a problem?
No, we have not had a landslide of decisions, but this is an issue that is faced by many courts to this day, and out in the field, some clarity on this issue would be extremely useful and important.
Is that the purpose of the Article 62, or is it to resolve the issue in the case before us at that time? Are you trying to make law, or are you trying to get this case resolved?
We want to get this case resolved, and we believe we can get this case resolved on the fact that there was no UCI in this case. The President didn't commit UCI, the Chief of Staff didn't commit UCI.
All right, well, I'll ask on the Article 37, since we seem to be going back to that, I just, if you could, what is the purpose of Article 37 in your opinion? Why did Congress enact that provision in the UCMJ?
It's to prevent a certain class of individuals from unfairly influencing a court-martial or proceeding.
And it's your argument that Congress would not have intended for the commander-in-chief to be included within that universe of officers or other personnel that could unfairly influence a court-martial?
Not unless the president was a convening authority.
Why would, that's not my question. Why would Congress have not included the president in that group of people? If the purpose of that 37 is to provide a fair trial free of influence to the accused, it seems a little strange they would not have intended to include the guy at the very top of the pyramid from being part of that group.
When you look at the code, it actually makes sense. The president's powers within the UCMJ are specified and limited. If, for example, under Article 4, if the president wants to dismiss an officer, he can demand a general court-martial and the president must convene it. So he cannot just go and order a dismissal of an officer. So it makes sense within the context of the code that they would limit Article 37 to who they wanted to prevent this type of behavior, and that's SJAs, commanders, convening authorities, those who have the mantle of authority in that case.
Well, Judge Ryan's ruling in Hutchins, her concurrence in Hutchins, certainly doesn't seem to agree with you. She seems to imply that senior leadership and the DOD can be subject to Article 37 as well. How do you differentiate, or how do you say that she's wrong?
Well, Your Honor, looking at her opinion and the Chief Judge's dissenting opinion, they rely on the fact that in the past, the Secretary of the Navy's instructions have been introduced in a court-martial, and that's in the U.S. v. Allen, and I don't have the cite on me right now, but I can get that to you, that had been introduced into a court-martial. Now, when you look at those cases, what was happening was the trial counsel, who is subject to the code, was using the mantle of authority of the Secretary of the Navy to interject it into the court-martial. So there's, to say that that would, you need someone from the code who's under Article 37 to be using those senior military officials' statements, which they are completely within their right. In fact, they have a duty to make those statements about crises such as these.
Counsel, do you believe that the leaning authority's affidavits, if they are aware of those statements, show that the statements have in fact been introduced into this process? And how is it any different than, and I'm sorry, there's a case where the defense counsel is the one who actually introduces the SAC policy memo and the court found it a reversible error because the SAC policy memo was introduced to the court?
Well, here, I'm not familiar with that case, Your Honor, but a lot of those cases were involving special court martials where there wasn't even a judge involved. So you have to look at the context of what we're talking about. If it's a case where there's no judge to arbitrate the matters, then it's one thing. If we're talking about a two-star general and a colonel, then I think it's a different standard. And if they're saying that there's no, that they've looked at the facts of this case and they decided it on the facts of this case, and there's zero evidence indicating that they didn't, in fact, there's evidence indicating the opposite, that they did consider it, that they did look at these independent facts, then I don't think that those two stand.
Counsel, down to the second, United States v. Brady, 15 NJ 275. In that case, it says, what is improper is the reference to such policy before members of the commander is in fact bringing the commander into this deliberation. So I'm asking you, hasn't this case shown that the president was in fact brought into the referral or pre-referral room, and is the convening authority's knowledge of that?
Your Honor, looking at the results, I think that it's clear that the president wasn't brought into it. When you say commander brought into the room, what the implication is that that person's will was overborne by that presence, not just that the commander was there. And in this case, the evidence indicates that the general's will was not overborne at all. He knew he had independent discretion. And the case law, since in Ayers, it is clear that officials can make statements about their expectations and their policies, and as long as the convening authorities do not allow it to disturb their discretion, then it's fine. It is not illegal.
Counsel, if that's the case, why did the government feel the need for the Secretary of Defense to issue a statement after the fact, after the President's statement, to address the President's statement and the other suggestions from senior leadership?
Well,
what was the point of the Secretary of Defense's statement?
If not repaired.
If not repaired.
It was a clarification, Your Honor, and I think the language of that memo talks about the clarification nature. I mean, there was nothing in the statements from the President or the Secretary of the Air Force that talked about curtailing rights. It talked about respecting rights, the rights of the victims. And we were not, so they were refocusing what the media had frankly pounced on and making sure that it was clear that the policy that had always been that every accused is entitled to a fair trial is understood to be the same policy.
If the media pounced on it, would that not kind of suggest the public had sort of pounced on it? And it, in that sense, being the perception of unfairness based on the comments made?
Well, if the media pounced on it, Your Honor, that still doesn't get it to the link of the case. That still is UCI in the air. It's still out there. It doesn't link to every sexual assault case. Ayers, they even talked about that just because you're in that sect of class, of the class of cases that they're talking about, that is not a logical connection.
Is there anything short of the commander, I guess the distinction sort of between circumstantial and direct evidence, anything short of the commander saying, yeah, my bad, it influenced me? I mean, notwithstanding the commander's denial in a letter, it almost sounds like you're saying, no matter how persuasive it may have appeared to the media, for example, no, there's not a sufficient indication that this commander was influenced by it. Are you making sort of, can you come up with, in your own mind, a situation where, well, you know, if we change these three facts, then it might be a different story? I don't need to ask such an open-ended question. I think the elephant in the room is the president, you know, a bunch of big hitters are talking about this. There have been general officers whose promotions have been, you know, sort of placed on hold, widely publicized. It seems like, you know, holy cow, this is here. Then in combination with Judge Pelican's question, that if it wasn't a problem, why the need for a reparative response? I just want to make sure I understand clearly, your threshold proposition is that there has not been a sufficient showing even of UCI to shift the burden to the government to come back and prove beyond a reasonable doubt. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. And looking at the public perception, if you look at the commanders that you're talking about being looked at because of their actions on a sexual assault case, General Franklin is still commander of 3rd Air Force. So if there was some sort of direct link, some sort of actual UCI where the president was reaching down and monkeying people's careers, that would be, even then, you'd need to connect it to the case. If that's happening with General Franklin's career, but there's nothing connecting it to U.S. v. Mobley, it's just not enough. We have heavy hitters. In the past, the Secretary of Defense was making statements in Ayers. Secretary of the Army was making statements in Simpson. These are heavy hitters, and there was a lot of publicity about the Aberdeen situation, and those were taking place in Aberdeen or Fort Lee, which was nearby, and it was the same sort of issue in the same sort of time. And there was no link.
So it's the government's position, just to be clear, that as long as the government proves that this particular convening authority was not influenced by any statements, that automatically eliminates any concern that a reasonable member of the public would have.
Yes.
So you're requiring actual that the convening authority was influenced, not just the perception that it could have happened.
The Superior Court, before the defense can meet their burden, our Superior Court has held that the defense has to show some evidence. Now, it's a lower threshold, but they still have to show some evidence of a logical connection. So if in this case, we were talking about a convening authority being affected, but if there was other evidence, then that may be enough to get them over the burden. There's other cases not involving public comment. I see I'm out of time, if I could finish on
that question.
There are other cases where not involving public comments by senior officials where the comments were found to have an effect on this particular case. And that's, I'll come up with that from my rebuttal, Your Honor, which case that is. But those are the ones where there was the commander or the convening authority has the mantle of authority in that case to commit UCI, and there's a link to that case. Unless there's further questions, if I may conclude.
So I don't want to restate your question or put words in the mouth. Circumstantial evidence can never establish apparent UCI, public opinion UCI. Did I make too far a leap there? Is that what you're saying?
I can't see how circumstantial evidence would not involving the case. I mean, it would have to be evidence from the case. Circumstantial evidence, I'm not really sure what you're getting at. Yeah, like,
okay, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
So,
Judge Whittier.
In conclusion, the military judge's predetermined result was an error. It must be overturned by this court, and this case returned to court-martial. Thank you very much.
Are you still wanting your rebuttal time?
Yes, sir.
Are you still asking for a rebuttal?
Yes, sir.
Okay, real. Defense? Excuse me, that's right. We're going to take a short break here, 5-minute break, if you will. Come on back. We'll reconvene.